So right up front, I need to let you in on a pretty unique behind-the-scenes fact about this deep dive.
Yeah, this is a fun one to share.
It really is. What you were listening to today is actually an initiative of Haifa Cafe. And to be totally transparent with you, both of us, the voices you are hearing right now, we are actually synthetic voices.
This is wild to think about, right?
Right. We are operating under the direction of Joseph Merrimon. And the core objective of this whole project is to disseminate foundational theories and texts. We want to make it easier for you to learn using real, validated information.
Yeah, getting away from just, you know, relying on random internet rumors or marketing hype.
Exactly. And that actually sets the perfect stage for today's source material.
It really does. Because today we are diving into a text that basically sought to validate the truth of human hearing itself.
It's a heavy hitter.
Oh, absolutely. We are looking at an incredibly influential two-part research paper from the National Research Council of Canada. It was authored by Floyd E. Toole.
And the title is Loudspeaker Measurements and Their Relationship to Listener Preferences.
Right.
So, the mission for today is to explore this mystery that just haunted the audio industry for decades. Mm-hmm. Like, for a very long time, evaluating speakers was a really messy, highly subjective business.
No, totally subjective.
You had designers relying on these golden ear reviewers who claimed they could hear, I don't know, mystical qualities that machines just couldn't capture.
The magic in the wires, basically.
Right. So the goal of Toole's research, and really our deep dive today, is to discover if it is actually possible to predict whether a speaker sounds good to a human being just by looking at objective mathematical measurements.
And to get to that answer, the paper forces us to confront this really fundamental psychometric problem in audio engineering.
It's a bit of a reality check, isn't it?
It's a massive reality check about our testing equipment. The core issue here is that a measuring microphone simply does not hear the world the way you do.
Which is funny because I think we tend to assume a microphone is just like a mechanical ear.
Yeah.
It captures the sound, so it must capture what we experience.
But that assumption is exactly the root of the problem. A measuring microphone performs a very simple transduction of air pressure.
Right.
It just takes the pressure fluctuations hitting its metal diaphragm and turns them into an electrical signal. It records everything equally. It has literally zero regard for the direction those sounds are coming from or, you know, how they interact with each other in time.
But human beings are vastly more complex than a metal diaphragm.
Oh, way more. We have two ears. They're separated by a physical head. And more importantly, we have a brain.
So it's like our auditory system is doing this heavy processing on that raw sound data before we even consciously register it as music.
Heavy processing is an understatement. I mean, take something like spectral modifications, your external ears, the actual fleshy ridges on the sides of your head.
The pinnod, right?
Yeah, exactly. They act as physical equalizers. Depending on whether a sound is coming from above you, below you, or behind you, those ridges physically alter the frequencies of the sound wave before it even hits your eardrum.
Wow.
And that filtering, that's the code your brain uses to map a sound in three-dimensional space.
So a measurement microphone, which is just a smooth metal cylinder.
That has no earlobes?
Right. It has no earlobes. It doesn't decode 3D space. It just captures a raw pressure sum.
Exactly. It's just a raw data dump.
It's kind of like comparing a microphone to the raw data from a camera sensor.
Yeah.
Right? And the human brain is like this sophisticated editing software that actively filters and prioritizes what's actually important.
That is a great analogy. And then there is the whole element of time. The text discusses temporal masking, which is just fascinating.
Yeah, let me see if I understand the mechanism correctly. If a speaker plays a very loud, sharp sound, like a snare drum crack, and there is a tiny, quiet distortion in the speaker cabinet that happens just a fraction of a millisecond later, a microphone is going to graph both of those acoustic events perfectly.
Right. It shows the loud sound and the quiet flaw right after it.
But your brain behaves entirely differently.
Completely differently. When the human auditory system receives that massive signal from the snare drum hit, it essentially turns down its own sensitivity for a brief moment.
To protect itself or just to process it?
To process the loud transient. So the brain actively masks the quieter sound that follows. You literally do not hear that secondary distortion, even though it physically exists in the air.
That is wild.
So the microphone catches the flaw and makes the speaker look terrible on a graph, but your brain deletes the flaw entirely.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because this means just because a graph looks bad to the eye doesn't mean it actually sounds bad to the ear.
Precisely. And the text points out some historical context that proves how deeply embedded this confusion was. way back in 1936.
Wait, 1936? Like before World War II?
Right. Yep. A researcher named Britton wrote a paper listing the common imperfections of electroacoustic systems.
Wow.
He laid out issues like amplitude response, harmonic distortion, and phase distortion. And the paper notes that Britton's list from 1936 held up remarkably well 50 years later when this research was being conducted.
So the pioneers of audio actually knew what the problems were before the industry even really took off.
They absolutely understood the theory. The bottleneck wasn't a lack of ideas, it was a lack of precision equipment.
Oh, right.
They didn't have the computer-controlled measurement systems or the processing power to correlate all that complex acoustic data with human perception.
So in the absence of hard, measurable proof, this massive industry sprouted up just relying on subjective opinions and marketing magic.
And a whole lot of rules of thumb.
Right. But this presents a massive hurdle for Tool. Because if we know the microphone is just a dumb pressure sensor, and the human brain is this complex, highly biased editing suite,
right,
how do you figure out which pieces of the microphone's raw data actually matter to the brain?
Well, you have to temporarily remove the bias of the human brain entirely.
Which sounds impossible.
It's difficult. You have to find out what human beings actually prefer when they were stripped of their preconceived notions, their brand loyalty, their visual biases.
If they can't see the shiny wood veneer on the speaker.
Exactly. You need a baseline of unvarnished truth, which requires an incredibly rigorous blind testing environment.
And Tool's methodology for this blind test is just staggering. They didn't just ask random people off the street.
No, no. They started with 42 highly experienced listeners.
So people who listen for a living, like recording engineers or trained audiophiles.
Right. And then he filtered that group down even further. Through preliminary testing, he isolated 28 listeners who exhibited the lowest judgment variability.
Meaning they were consistent. Like, if they rated a speaker a certain way on Tuesday, they rated it the exact same way on Thursday. They weren't just guessing.
Exactly. And he also ensured these 28 listeners all had near normal hearing thresholds. He verified that their hearing was within 10 decibels of an international audiometric zero baseline.
Okay, so he needed to be absolutely sure he was getting a reliable baseline human response, completely free of any significant physical hearing impairment.
Right. And to capture that response, they used a highly standardized scoring system. They utilized a 0 to 10 fidelity scale.
Based on an internationally recognized acoustic grading standard.
Right.
Yeah, the IEC publication 26813. A score of 10 means the reproduction is perfectly faithful to the original recording. Like, no improvement is even imaginable.
And a 0?
A 0 means the sound is an unrecognizable disaster.
Okay, so the rigorous nature of the listeners and the grading scale gives the data immense credibility. But the way they administered the test is where things get really interesting to me.
The mono versus stereo thing.
Yes. This was a detail in the methodology that initially made absolutely no sense to me.
But it throws a lot of people off.
All of the fidelity ratings that Tool used to correlate the data,
yeah,
the final scores that determined what a good speaker was, came exclusively from monophonic listening tests.
Yep. One single speaker at a time.
I really have to push back on that approach. I mean, why test in mono when literally everyone listens to music in stereo at home? Doesn't testing one speaker fundamentally break the real-world application of the research?
It seems entirely counterintuitive, right? Until you look at how our brains process complex audio fields. The text explains that stereo actually acts as a psychoacoustic mask.
A mask?
Yeah. It hides the mechanical flaws of the loudspeaker.
Okay, let me see if I can puzzle this out. So in a stereo setup, if two speakers are playing the exact same vocal track, I don't hear a voice in the left speaker and a voice in the right.
Right, you hear it in the middle.
My brain hallucinates a phantom ghost singer standing in the dead center of the room.
That phantom image is a cognitive construct. Your brain is actively expending processing power to build a spatial illusion. And what Tool discovered in his testing was that highly rated, excellent loudspeakers received very similar scores whether they were listened to in mono or stereo.
Their inherent quality shone through either way.
Right. But the bad speakers behave drastically differently.
Oh, let me guess. The poorly engineered loudspeakers received artificially elevated ratings when they were tested in stereo.
Exactly. The text refers to this as a scaling distortion.
Because the brain is so distracted by the mental gymnastics of building that cool 3D stereo hologram, it just stops paying attention to the fact that the singer's voice sounds teeny or distorted.
It is a magic trick that distracts the audience. The stereo effect increases judgment variability among the listeners. So by forcing the listeners to evaluate the speakers in mono, Tool stripped away the illusion.
That makes a lot of sense.
Mono testing forces the brain to focus entirely on the raw tonal quality and the spatial dispersion of that single sound source. It leaves the speaker completely naked in the room.
With nowhere to hide its flaws.
Precisely.
That is a brilliant piece of experimental design. Because by removing the stereo illusion, you isolate the actual capability of the hardware.
Exactly.
So Tool forces these highly consistent listeners to hear the unvarnished truth in mono. And once he did that, a clear consensus emerged on which speakers sounded the best.
They absolutely agreed.
Which brings us to the core mission today. What did the measurements of those winning speakers actually look like?
Well, the big reveal from the data is beautifully straightforward in theory, though it is notoriously difficult to execute in manufacturing.
Okay, what is it?
The data proved that what listeners universally prefer is a flat, smooth, wideband, on-axis amplitude response.
Okay, let's break that down for everyone. Amplitude response is essentially how evenly the speaker plays all the different frequencies of sound, from the deep bass to the high treble.
Right.
And on-axis means you're sitting directly in front of the speaker, right in its line of fire.
Yep.
So a flat and smooth response means the speaker isn't artificially hyping the bass to sound powerful or boosting the treble to sound hyper-detailed.
It acts like a clean window, just letting the original signal pass through without adding its own color.
But the complexity arises because a flat on-axis response isn't enough on its own, right?
Not at all. And this is the most crucial caveat, and really the area where the vast majority of loudspeakers fail. The paper's data showed that this smooth amplitude response must be maintained at substantial angles off axis.
Which makes me think of a flashlight. Like, think of a speaker radiating sound, like a flashlight radiating light.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it.
If you shine a flashlight at a wall, the on-axis response is that bright, intense white hot spot right in the exact center of the beam.
Right.
Now, a lot of cheap flashlights have a really bright center, but as soon as you look at the spill light around that center, the off-axis, right, the light gets all blotchy. You see jagged rings of blue and yellow light.
The center is accurate, but the periphery is corrupted.
Exactly. Now, imagine shining that cheap flashlight in a room with highly reflective mirrors on the side walls.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That bright white center hits the wall in front of you. But those jagged yellow and blue rings bounce off the mirrors and hit your eyes from the sides. Suddenly, your brain is trying to make sense of a room that is bathed in weird, conflicting colors. The overall illusion is ruined.
And that physical reflection of light perfectly mirrors the acoustic reflection of sound in your living room.
Because the sound shooting out to the sides hits the walls.
The sound hits your sidewalls, the ceiling, the floor, and those sound waves eventually bounce back and reach your ears as early reflections.
And because our auditory system integrates all those reflections with the direct sound, if the off-axis sound is jagged, the brain hears two conflicting tonal balances.
Right. The direct sound is smooth, but the reflections are screechy.
Exactly.
The data introduces a really important metric here called the directivity index.
Directivity index.
Yeah, it's essentially a mathematical ratio comparing the sound radiating straight ahead to the total sound power radiating in all directions. And Tool proved that if a loudspeaker exhibits a smooth directivity index, meaning the off-axis sound is just a progressively quieter but tonally identical copy of the on-axis sound,
listeners will consistently rate it higher.
Every time. The reflections match the direct sound, so the brain's integration process is completely seamless.
Okay, so we know we need smoothness straight ahead and smoothness out to the sides. But what about the low end? I mean, if you spend any time on audio forums, you know people obsess over bass response.
Oh, bass is a massive driver of listener preference, and the data absolutely bore this out. But Tool analyzed it in a very specific, deliberate way.
How so?
He didn't just measure the absolute lowest frequency a massive subwoofer could theoretically produce. He looked at the low frequency cutoff relative to the core of the music.
But how do you establish the core of the music as a mathematical baseline? I mean, music varies so much.
He calculated the mean on-axis response in what is termed the essential voice frequency range.
Which is what exactly?
It sits right between 300 and 3,000 hertz. Evolutionary biology dictates that human hearing is hypersensitive to this specific range.
Because that's where human speech lives.
Exactly. It is the loudest, most critical part of our acoustic world. So Tool used that vocal range as the baseline volume.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. You judge the bass based on how it balances with the human voice.
He then measured where the bass dropped off by 5 decibels and by 10 decibels relative to that vocal bass line.
And what did the data say?
The statistical correlation was undeniable. The further down the bass frequencies extended smoothly before hitting that minus 5 and minus 10 decibel cutoff, the higher the fidelity rating from the blind testing panel.
So smooth, deep extension relative to the mid-range equals high subjective preference.
Every single time.
So we have established a clear anatomical profile for a perfect speaker here. Flat amplitude response on axis, smoothly matched directivity off axis, and deep, even bass extension.
That's the recipe.
But if you look at the marketing brochures for high-end audio gear, they're selling dozens of other deeply complex measurements.
They love their jargon.
They really do.
Yeah.
And the one that always stands out to me is phase response. Companies market phase coherent designs as the ultimate holy grail of acoustic engineering.
Right.
Does the objective data from tools research actually support that obsession?
And this is where the paper actively dismantles some deeply entrenched audio myths. When the research team analyzed the data on phase response, the findings provided a massive reality check.
Really? Because they charge a lot of money for phase coherent speakers.
I know. But phase response is essentially just the timing alignment of all the different frequencies. And it is true that the highly rated speakers tended to have a generally smooth phase response.
Okay, so it does matter a little bit.
A little bit, yes. However, the data revealed that the phase response did not need to be of any particular overall shape.
Wait, if phase is just the timing alignment, you're saying the human brain doesn't actually care if a low bass note arrives a tiny fraction of a millisecond later than a high treble note?
Not really, no.
There isn't a rigid, perfectly aligned shape that everyone prefers.
The objective data strongly suggests that there isn't, and the mechanism behind this brings us right back to psychometrics and auditory masking.
The brain tricks again.
Exactly. The human brain is not an oscilloscope. It smears tiny timing errors. The auditory masking effects we discussed earlier render many minor phase anomalies completely invisible to the listener.
So the brain's editing software just glosses over the timing errors so it can focus on the melody and the tonal balance.
Exactly. While a smooth phase curve is often a natural byproduct of a generally well-engineered loudspeaker.
It just happens by accident if the rest is good.
Usually, yeah. But agonizing over achieving a perfectly linear, mathematically flawless phase response, it simply does not correlate strongly with a higher subjective fidelity rating.
Because the human ear just isn't as sensitive to those microscopic timing alignments as the marketing departments want consumers to believe.
They want you to buy a new speaker, not trust your own ears.
Which brings us to the ultimate synthesis of this entire deep dive. Tool essentially proved that the age-old war between subjective art and objective science in audio engineering is basically a false dichotomy.
Totally false. Objective measurements absolutely can parallel subjective measurements.
If a speaker has excellent technical performance in these very specific, psychoacoustically relevant terms.
Flat on axis, smooth off axis, extended bass.
Right. If it has those, it will sound good to almost everyone in a normal listening environment.
The paper draws a definitive, mathematically backed conclusion. A loudspeaker that exhibits good technical performance in these specific metrics will inherently sound good in the listening room.
And vice versa. A speaker that sounds genuinely good in a blind test will possess these specific technical measurements.
Always. And when you scale this realization across an entire industry, the impact is staggering. I mean, the paper points out the massive labor and cost savings this data unlocks.
Because for decades, manufacturers were running these tedious, uncalibrated listening tests.
Yeah, with golden ear reviewers who could be thrown off by the acoustic reflections of the room or the psychoacoustic trickery of the stereo illusion.
Or just having a bad day and a headache.
Exactly. This research allowed designers to establish computer-controlled measurement facilities.
So instead of guessing, once an engineering team maps the on-axis and off-axis amplitude response,
they can rapidly iterate. They can design acoustic products that they know, with mathematical certainty, the vast majority of the human population will absolutely love.
It entirely replaces guesswork with applied science.
It does.
It really democratizes high fidelity. It proves that you don't need mystical materials or proprietary magic wires to build a world-class speaker. You just need to understand the data that actually matters to the human brain.
It replaces untrustworthy, highly biased personal opinions with scientific proof. The enduring legacy of Tool's research is showing that humans actually share a highly predictable common preference for what constitutes great sound.
Despite our varying tastes in musical genres.
Right. The underlying physical requirements for our auditory satisfaction are nearly universal.
So for you, the listener, the practical takeaway here is honestly empowering. The next time you are evaluating audio gear or honestly any piece of consumer technology that interacts with your senses, you can confidently look past the marketing jargon.
Please do.
When you see a shiny brochure emphasizing phase coherence or some other exotic buzzword, ask yourself, what objective measurements actually correlate to human enjoyment?
Is the response smooth? Is the directivity consistent?
Right. You learn to demand the data that actually dictates the experience.
Because as this research illuminates, the truth of human preference isn't hidden in the subjective ether. It is hiding right there in the math.
It really is. And, you know, we often assume that our subjective taste in things like audio is unmeasurable.
Yeah.
Like it's this murky landscape of personal artistry and individual quirk.
We like to think we're all entirely unique.
Right. But this research proved that our subjective enjoyment of reproduced sound isn't random at all. It is a universally shared biological trait, and it is mathematically predictable. Which leaves you with a final thought to mull over today.
Okay, what is it?
If our deep emotional connection to the physical sound of music can be perfectly mapped by a microphone and an algorithm,
yeah.
What other deeply personal, subjective, artistic tastes in your life might actually be entirely predictable by the right data set?